Welcome to the podcast Jagti, Ukraine Life. Jagti means in Ukrainian, how are you? I'm your host, Lucia Cirki, a former correspondent, now a freelancer and a book author. The aim of this podcast is always to give people in Ukraine an opportunity to share their very personal experience of Russia's full-scale invasion. I'm more than delighted to welcome today's guest, Timur Jafarov. Timur is a soldier with the armed forces of Ukraine since the very beginning of the full-scale invasion. Before, he has been an experimental electronic musician from Kyiv, recording as John Object. Welcome to the podcast, Timur.
Hi, thank you for having me.
As always, I start this podcast with a question. Jagti zaraz, how are you right now?
Today, relatively fine, because I got a day off from my military service. I usually have to come in on a Saturday, which today is a Saturday. I've been like indulging in my hobbies, which is I'm soldering a guitar pedal today, which is fun. Enjoying myself today. And there haven't been massive attacks on Kyiv in the past couple of days, which is nice. I guess that's it.
We are recording today on a Saturday. Like on the past few days, diplomatic talks were ongoing between the United States and Ukraine and between the United States and Russia. As a soldier of the armed forces of Ukraine, what do you think about these talks?
I think, obviously, that they are extremely unfair. And I feel really bad for our president, because for better or worse, I support him. I think he's a decent human being. I think he's doing the best that he can in the situation. And he's constantly being humiliated on the world stage, being put into this horrible position of having to either accept unacceptable terms or look like a person who wants the war to go on, which is, what are you going to do? There's no way out for him. And I guess because of that, for all of us. So I'm really angry. I'm pissed off. I'm not happy with it at all. That's why I try to not follow the news too closely, because it's just, if I think about it too much, I realize that there will come a time soon when, maybe not very soon, but at some point, when the world is basically okay with everything that the Russians did and everyone just wants us to accept it and move on and like be friends with them or something. I wish people who are planning this for us, who are facilitating this situation and putting Ukraine in a situation, would imagine what it's like when Russians just kill your whole family. Like they just, because of course it's happened many times, you know, Russians have killed many families, and the people whose families were killed, often they're still alive, they're still reading the news, watching this. Just imagine having both of your parents killed with a drone or a rocket. And that's like, you're going to live with that for the rest of your life. Your parents will always be killed by Russians for no reason at all, for being completely innocent, normal people living in a country that was just happened to be near Russia. And I wish that people that are making the decisions right now would imagine what it's like to live with that, and then for the rest of your life to know that, yeah, and Russians, no one ever punished them for it, you know. Everyone just kind of shrugged it off, and it's like, yeah, well, it happens. Get over it. Those are my feelings, you know.
I have, like, several follow-up questions onto this, and especially on how you see the future of Ukraine. But before, I would like to talk about the past and about your childhood, about your roots. You were born in Kyiv in 1995, so 4 years after Ukraine became independent. How would you describe your childhood growing up in Kyiv at that time?
I think it was kind of like being a tourist in a Soviet Union, maybe, I would imagine, in my early childhood, because everything around me still looked Soviet. It was still, you know, my high school and my school and my, what do you call it, kindergarten would have been built in the Soviet Union. All the furniture was from there, all the toys, all the games and everything. And a lot of the people around me were still adults, were still had the mindset of, I would imagine, a Soviet person. And so, but the tourist part comes from the fact that I was not taught to love the Soviet Union. I was not limited by the censorship and the repressions, I suppose, of the Soviet Union. So I could just be myself. I could grow up as a person that is free from it, but I was still in the same kind of environment. And a lot of the mentalities were still present around me. Otherwise, I mean, my childhood was fine. My parents were, still are, pretty progressive aesthetically. So we were not a well-off family. In fact, we were quite poor, but we had Western music, rock music and pop, and we had kind of a fashion sense about it all. We had taste in furniture and everything. And my father was, still is, sorry. Why do I keep saying that? It's grim, right? My father is a photographer, so he had Western cameras, and or actually Eastern, because it would be from Japan. It was cool. I thought that we were trying to act Western and European, occasionally American, you know. Compared to someone actually from a more developed country, we probably had... We looked extremely poor and maybe kind of tasteless, but compared to people from Ukraine at the time, it was like, yeah, my parents have, you know, a better apartment or something. Like, we have posters of foreign painters and movies and stuff. It was, you know, this cultural intelligentsia, I guess you would call it. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad I grew up on Western rock music, because that was the better option among everything that was available.
You already mentioned your father. I read in an interview that your father came to Kyiv for his studies, where he met your mother. Your father's ethnicity is Tabasaran. This minority is from the Northern Caucasus, a region that has been conquered by Russia in the beginning of the 19th century. The Tabasarans suffered from Russian and Soviet imperialism tremendously. How did your father's heritage influence or shape you personally?
I think I was lucky to avoid this kind of monocultural view of the world, because obviously it's always beneficial to have several cultures in your home. Well, in my opinion. And generally, I think it was a privilege to have two varieties of cuisine, you know, at home, which is wonderful. The Tabasaran cuisine is delicious. It's awesome. It's a lot of meat, so I'm not very much into it these days, but it's good. It's very different from Ukrainian, I think. And of course, my mother would cook wonderful Ukrainian cuisine, so I had the best of both worlds. I think generally we never really spoke with my father, especially about his background. It was never really much of a conversation topic, because I think he wanted to fit in more than anything. So looking like, well, technically a foreigner wouldn't have done him any favors in Ukraine, especially at the, you know, in the early 2000s, maybe, because that was still... The national sentiments were still kind of tricky. There were still divisions between people. And having come from relatively far away would have been not necessarily a problem, but it wouldn't have been beneficial in social situations and parties, when meeting new people, when applying for a job, I suppose. You know, not a huge problem, but just... there wasn't really a point to it.
What is your family's relationship nowadays towards people they know or are even related to in Russia? What is their relationship today?
I don't know. I haven't really asked, but my father's parents and several other relatives had moved to Ukraine way back in the 90s as well. So I would imagine it's not... We don't have any close relatives living in Russia right now. I'll say that. And I don't expect any of my relatives to be in touch with someone necessarily, because it's almost impossible to square up the differences of the quality of life, essentially. My father, he left Ukraine a while ago. He lives in Europe now. I'm not going to say which country, because he moves a little bit for work, basically. And my grandmother, she lives in Italy now with other relatives as well. So they're not necessarily experiencing the Ukrainian life at the moment, but they're well aware of what's happening. And my relatives in Italy are doing a lot of activism and a lot of helping the refugees from Ukraine. I would imagine they know better than to be in touch with anyone from Russia, because what's the point?
You're serving in the Ukrainian army since the very beginning of the full-scale invasion. I assume during your service you might have encountered minorities from the North Caucasus, maybe even Tabasarans on the other side of the front line, right? Fighting for the Russian army. Did you ever have that thought? And what strategies, if you had that thought, did help you to distance yourself personally?
Well, I didn't necessarily encounter Russians to the point where I can speak to them or even see them too clearly. I've only seen them through like the scope and the binoculars or from a drone. So I never thought to consider this, to be honest, because to be frank, I also don't really consider myself Tabasaran, because I feel like since I was born here, I was raised here, and the only thing that's kind of tying me to that area is the DNA, I suppose, because I've never been there. Maybe some cultural background in terms of the cuisine that I like. For the sake of the argument, let's imagine, you know, some Tabasaran soldier shooting at me, which is, by the way, it's a very small nation at this point. I think there's like just several hundred maybe people still alive. Let's imagine, it doesn't matter. Who cares? You know, Ukraine is also a multinational country to a smaller degree than Russia, certainly, but Crimean Tatars, for example, are quite different from Ukrainians in terms of culture, but we're still together in this fight. The ethnicity is really irrelevant, I think, because it's what's in your head that counts, essentially. So if a Tabasaran soldier wants to come to Ukraine and shoot at me, he's no different to me than any other Russian soldier, to be honest. Because I'm no different to him than any other Ukrainian, right? So he's not going to ask me, oh, do you have relatives in, you know, northern Caucasus? Who cares?
Before the full-scale invasion, you had a very different life. Like professionally, you were on your path to become a successful musician. How did you become interested in experimental electronic music, and what makes it fascinating for you?
Well, thank you for those kind words. I don't know if I would have become necessarily successful, because, you know, it didn't happen for the first almost 10 years. So why would it happen now? But the experiment...
I read that you were considered to be one of the, you know, aspiring musicians. You know, I read that just in articles, so I assumed you were on your path.
I suppose in Ukraine I had some local following, which is very nice, of course. I certainly appreciate that. But I feel like I was not on the way towards, you know, paying the bills from music. Certainly it wouldn't have covered my day-to-day existence ever. But the experimental stuff, I think it interested me because I feel like the feeling of novelty when you're listening to something, the experience of encountering something that you've never encountered before, never thought possible and never could imagine, is something that I enjoy a lot. When I hear music that's unlike anything else I've heard before, to me that is the feeling that I chase. That's the feeling that I look for in music. That is something that I enjoy more than pop music or hip hop or whatever it may be that's built on the same kind of tradition every time. And yeah, I just felt like I had some ideas for sounds that I've not heard in music ever. So I wanted to offer them to people. And some people do enjoy hearing something that's unlike anything else. And besides, there was always this nagging feeling that we're getting kind of stuck with electronic music. Because technically, with a computer, just a computer, that's it. You can make any sound in the world, technically, you know, if you spend enough time. Because you can model it using like physics modeling. You can do sampling, synthesis, any, you know, any old technology you can use. And technically, they're unlimited in their possibilities. And I felt like we've never really gone through every sound in the world. In fact, there's a bunch of sounds that we hear every day, especially sounds of the human body, sounds of, you know, everyday life in an apartment or in the street that we don't use in music. And hell, why not? That was, I suppose, one of the reasons why I went in that direction.
You have trained your ears for years, yeah, to pay attention to the sounds in your surroundings, right? And you record it?
Yeah, I would often, there would be many times when I would be, you know, in the street or somewhere with friends and I'd, whoa, what is that sound? That is awesome. And I would pull out my phone, record something, be like, I'm going to make a track out of this at some point. I don't finish a lot of music. There's a lot of sketches that I haven't put out, but trust me, there's some stuff based on like my footsteps on the floor somewhere. Or there was also a time when me and my friend, we found a bat that was dying under like next to a supermarket somewhere on the ground. And it was like screeching, making these horrible sounds of pain, like very high pitched. Kind of sounded like an alarm or something. And I recorded that and I thought, oh, maybe I could do something with this. But that would have been winter of 21. So right before the war, and no wonder I never finished anything.
How did the war change your way of listening?
I've started to listen to a lot less music because for the first year maybe or something, I didn't even check out like the new albums or whatever, something that was coming out because I was in service and it was very hard to find a time and a place where you could put on headphones and just zone out for half an hour even. So that just basically destroyed my ability to kind of be in touch with what's happening in the music scene, which is another reason why my career has kind of taken a dive, is because I'm just not aware of what's happening, what other musicians are making. So I feel like I'm not part of the scene anymore, which, you know, that's what happens when you can't make music for 3 years. But my listening habits, I suppose you always have to listen to every weird sound that's happening in the world somewhere, like in the sky above you, like somewhere on the horizon, somewhere close by. You have to listen to everything that's not musical. That's why I feel like listening to experimental and electronic music is not really an option, because a lot of that music will feature the weirdest sounds, like just anything you can think of, it's going to be in the music somewhere, which is tricky, because if you're listening to something on headphones and you hear something like a siren or something like an explosion, you have to take the headphones out and be like, wait, is that in the street or is that in the track? So I'm right now, I've listened to mostly stuff that's just songs, you know, guitar-based music, some synth pop from the 80s, but just experimental stuff is no longer interesting because it just gives me so much anxiety and so much fear. I don't know what to do with that because I feel like that's not going to change even after a ceasefire. It's still going to, somewhere in there in my head, it's going to be there. But we'll see.
During your service in the army, you had been very close to the front lines. Did you take special precautions to protect your hearing as a musician?
I haven't been close to the front line all the time, you know. Occasionally, yes, but not. I spent a lot of time in the rear when I was just making documents and, you know, typing stuff and translating manuals. But yeah, at the front line, I took no precautions. I don't know why, but I suppose as someone who's like just a soldier, you know, private, just the lowest rank in the military, I didn't really have a lot of options. I could have bought myself, you know, some kind of protective headphone system or something, but those are quite expensive, firstly. Secondly, those are valuable, and I would imagine that someone would ask me if they can borrow it, and it would then, you know, trade hands all the time. I'd have to give it to someone else who's going to the front line, which is cool. But I just didn't want to deal with the hassle of having that system because it's valuable. People want it. So if I were to buy it for myself, it would be stupid to say, oh, you know, I just bought this because I'm a musician. I want to protect my hearing. It's like, that seems awkward. You know, I don't want to do that. And besides, like being a soldier, being a private, one of the things you learn pretty quickly is that you always have to be listening for your commander, because they might call you from somewhere, you know, like yell your name and you have to run over there. It's tricky. You can't have your ears blocked or plugged or have something in them. You have to always be like ready to hear what's happening. And besides, a lot of my work specifically was based on actually hearing the enemy artillery, for example, from way far off and be like, oh, I think they're starting to, you know, shoot at us. So you have to actually listen to the quiet sounds a lot of the time. If I was in artillery as one of the operators of the howitzer or mortar, then certainly I would have gotten myself something to protect myself because that's extremely loud. But I was in artillery, but in artillery reconnaissance, which means that you actually have to listen. So I never got any hearing protection, which now I kind of regret, because in the trenches, when they were firing on us, I feel like I've damaged my hearing pretty. I want to say like it's 20% gone, maybe, you know, which is fine. I can still live normally, but I have to, if I'm listening to music on my AirPods, I have to turn it way up to the maximum, which doesn't feel good, but it's okay.
Did you have the chance to talk with a specialist, you know, to have a look?
Oh, no, I didn't go out of my way to, like, go see a doctor. I mean, I'm still in the military service. I'm just continuing it from Kyiv, which means I don't have a lot of free time, and the one time to go, for example, would be today, Saturday, because I would imagine the doctors don't really see patients on Sundays, or maybe not even on Saturdays, I don't know. But if I have the option to sit at home and solder a guitar pedal, I'm probably going to do that. It's way more fun. I'm sorry. I feel I put off a lot of medical issues. You know, I have other health issues that I probably should see a doctor about, but I just want to live a little, you know. I'm tired of constantly facing problems, so I'm like putting them off. Eventually, it's going to catch up with me, I know. But right now, I'm mentally in a difficult space where I need to entertain myself at least a little bit to stay sane, maybe. I don't know. But it's a good question. Yeah, I should probably get on that.
You told in an interview before that it doesn't feel right to make music now because from your point of view, it doesn't matter. Do you mean it doesn't matter for you personally, or it does not matter for, in general, the Ukrainian society as a whole, if one can say so?
Mm, It's a good question. I would say that neither. I think it doesn't matter to the world in general, because Ukrainians, they like my music, well, some of them, and I love that they like my music, so I would be happy to provide music to Ukrainians and do something for us. But once that music goes out into the world, I realize that I found that people are very good at separating art from the artist, you know, which is a horrible thing. I think you should never do it, because music is political, all art is political, everything is political. But what happens is that people are able to play my music and put my tracks in DJ mixes and all that stuff without realizing that Russians are killing us. And, you know, they can listen to my music and still be friends with Russians and still be totally ignorant of what's happening here. And that just, it annoys me very much. It makes me very angry. So I'd rather not offer any music to foreigners at this point, because if it's not going to help us win the war, then what's the point? Because my dream now is to win the war. It's not to have a career and be a musician. That would be cool, and I'm going to still keep working on that, but winning the war is much more important. And if I have to sacrifice some kind of success, however small it may have been, I can do that. It doesn't really matter. I'm insulted and pissed off by people from other countries listening to my music and ignoring the context, you know, and just not donating to my fundraisers, you know, not helping Ukraine in other ways, not putting pressure on their own politicians, which are making decisions for us right now. And, you know, when Germany sent us 10 Leopard 1 tanks, I think, which were in such a horrible condition that we had to send them back, because these are like tanks from the 80s or 70s. Okay, but like, obviously no one's going to give us new weapons because everyone needs them, despite no one being engaged in a war. Okay, but those were not only old tanks. They were also in such a horrible condition that Ukrainian specialists, they looked at them and they were like, no, we can't accept them because we'd have to fix them, and we can't even fix them. They're beyond repair. So we send them back. And to know that Germans are, you know, some Germans maybe listening to my music and didn't really get Olaf Scholz, you know, to step down, or didn't impeach him at the time for this, to me is insulting. Like, you don't get to listen to my music if you think it's okay to send broken tanks to Ukraine. If you think that's fine, you know, as a German, you should probably not be listening to my music, because it feels like a lot of people in the world that are listening to my music are basically would be okay with me being killed, you know, or they wouldn't want it to happen, but they're not going to do anything about it. So why should I entertain these people? What's the point? Which is why I think the music that I still have time to make right now, I'd much rather it was just for the Ukrainians. So I have a new project that is basically centered around my nostalgia for a lot of Ukrainian things from my childhood, you know, Ukrainian TV, Ukrainian radio, Ukrainian music that was made in the 90s by underground acts that was quite wonderful. And I'm just working with that. And that music is not designed for foreigners. It's the titles and the song lyrics are in Ukrainian, so I'm not giving it to anyone. I have to give it away during fundraisers because I need something to entice people to give me the money. So I do kind of share it a little bit. But officially, I'm not putting it out on my main accounts and I'm not showing it to anyone. I wish I didn't have to give it out as part of a fundraiser. I wish it was like a total secret from the world, just for the Ukrainians. But it, so far, I've not been able to do that.
You said that every music is political. When did you realize that music is political?
I think if you listen to enough music, it just kind of comes to you naturally. I don't know when, but maybe in my early teenage years, maybe, because I was discovering David Bowie and Kraftwerk, and both David Bowie and Kraftwerk have these really intense political connotations to their music. I think Bowie at one point, when he said that he was gay, which he really wasn't, but he said it just to kind of make a scandal. I think that was a very interesting move, and it's hard growing up in Ukraine, listening to his music and interacting with other people who knew who he was. It was hard to escape the question about, what do you think about him being gay? Like, are you okay with that? And so, of course, that was immediately like one of the things that I had to confront. And, you know, I'm fine with it. I think it's cool, you know, if he were actually gay. But it was like a big question. And also Kraftwerk as well, which is like the first generation of musicians born after the World War, having to build a culture from scratch, basically, because there was nothing that you could preserve and build on. It was all, you know, crap. And you had to burn it all down, which is good. And I think Kraftwerk were smart in doing what they did, and I think it was great music. But of course it's political. It's hard not to see that. Also the Smiths with Morrissey, you know, being a horrible racist, you know, which when I was first discovering them in my teenage years, I don't know if that was, I think he had some kind of controversies at that point already, but boy, it got way worse. So it's hard not to realize that, well, I'm listening to this music, what if it's gonna make me a racist or something? What if subconsciously it has some weird effect? Maybe it has like some magical sounds in the music to make you racist, who knows? You know, it made me feel weird as a teenager, so I would listen to the Smiths, but not so much Morrissey, I think. Yeah, it just kind of comes to you. It's hard to... And also, of course, my Ukrainian background, the fact that I'm Ukrainian is also kind of a big part of it, because there was a lot of Russian music that would cross the border and kind of play on the radio. And yet you could... Very often you could Google one of the artists and they would have said something horrible about Ukrainians in an interview. And be like, what the hell? How is it okay to listen to this? So living in a country that is essentially an ex-colony or one of the smaller countries that has been, you know, occupied for its whole history is tricky, because you have to make sure that the artists that you're listening to are not supporting killing you and everyone you know. So yeah, it's inherent that as a Ukrainian, you can't separate art from artists. You have to understand that it's political. It's always going to be political. And I think someone from the US, for example, or someone from Germany or Britain, maybe they don't need to do that. Maybe they have the luxury of being like, yeah, I'll be fine. Even if this, you know, Russian musician thinks I should be killed, you know, we'll win the war. If they have to, you know, fight with us, we'll come out on top. For Ukrainian, it's different. So I guess that's the answer.
And did that change for you, like, 11 years ago during the Maidan and after annexation of Crimea by Russia? Or did it change for you like when the full-scale invasion started? When did that change for you?
I mean, I definitely was conscious of all of this before the full-scale invasion. I was always, well, not always, but there were musical artists that I used to like, and then I would like cancel them, you know, by deleting them, removing them from my library if they had done or said something just horrific. Morrissey, you know, for example, one of the musicians who I used to like, and I think his music has, there's a lot of great songs there, but I'm just not, I don't feel comfortable listening to it. So I kind of removed him from my library. It wasn't something that I was kind of translating into the world. It wasn't something that I was telling people to do. I was just, it's my own personal preference. I'm not comfortable with it, and I'm not lecturing my friends or people on the internet about it. It was fine. Regarding when that changed, it's hard to, I don't think I have an answer, because I, to know, I would have to compare growing up in a country in which the war never happened. You know, I can't tell, because when Maidan happened and I was there as well with my friends, I would have been 17 or 18, which is just, you know, the beginning of adulthood, I suppose. So I think regardless of what would have happened in Ukraine at that point, that's a time in life when you become conscious, when you become more mature and adult, and you realize that you have to vote in the next election, and realize that you have to kind of draw political lines between yourself and the world. So who knows? Who knows? I don't know whether it was because of Maidan, or I think it's probably because that's what happens when you grow up, unless you're extremely privileged and sheltered and you don't have to care about politics. But that's very few people.
You already mentioned that you're joining us today from your hometown, Kyiv, and you came back to the city after serving in a more combat-engaged brigade in eastern Ukraine, and you described your current duty in the army to be more like an office job. What made you switch positions within the Ukrainian army?
Well, it's scary. I'm a coward. What can I say? I mean, it's...
What do you mean you're a coward?
I mean, it's horrifying to be at the front lines. You know, I don't want to be there. I feel like there are... I've seen people who seem to be more mentally stable. But of course, yeah, I don't know. I can't compare. What happened was essentially I was offered a job in Kyiv. I didn't look for it. I didn't seek it out. I was just offered a position here. And of course, if once I was offered it, I said, yeah, because it's hard to say no. And also it was, what I do now is a bit more tailored to my specific set of skills, which means that I'm probably more useful and more efficient here. I hope so. So yeah, it was just that someone found me and called me and offered me a different position. And I was, yeah, sure, get me out of here. But of course, it took a long time. I was waiting to transfer for about a year or something. And that's just awful. Waiting, you know, and thinking, oh, maybe today I'll get the papers and I'll, you know, get in the car and drive to Kyiv. Maybe, who knows? Maybe today. And it's like every day you wake up thinking that. It's really hard. It may have made my service a lot harder than it would have been otherwise if I didn't have this false hope that it can happen any day now. But yeah, I'm here now, which is cool.
Coming back to Kyiv has not been easy for you. What made adaption to life far from the front line more difficult for you?
It's a good question. I think my relationships with a lot of my friends, especially male friends, have suffered. Because, first of all, of course, I was away, so I was not aware of everything that's been happening. I've not been going to the same bars and clubs and venues. I've not met the same new people that everyone that I know has met. I've not been basically part of the crowd, which means that I don't get a lot of the jokes. I miss out on a lot of the cultural events. But also, of course, the male friends who did not enlist, we have kind of a harder relationship now because I think me kind of being here reminds them that someday they will have to go and serve as well. And a lot of people maybe would rather not think about it because it's a scary thought. And I get it, but also it's just this weird damage that's hard to... It's hard to talk about it. It's hard to discuss it with anyone because no one wants to talk about it, of course. And maybe after a couple of drinks, you know, some things can come out that are strange and hard to put into words. I think it's fine. You know, I'm not personally mad at anyone. I don't think no one owes me anything, you know, but it just creates this barrier that's hard to overcome. And I'd like to tell people that, you know, I'm fine with it. There's no barrier. You can talk to me. You can be my friend. You can be honest with me. But I think on the other side, when I'm talking to someone, you know, maybe they feel it. It's gotten better lately because I've been here for a while, you know. But when I first got here, I felt a big divide between me and people that I used to know. A lot of it also has to do with the everyday life being so different, because I would come here and I would have to learn how to socialize, how to say hi to people, how to talk to people, how to cook, and how to what to wear, you know, because I totally lost my fashion sense, by the way, which I don't even remember what I was wearing before the service. So yeah, it's a lot of it is my problem, because I've forgotten how to live, basically. So you have to learn again, maybe.
Do you have the impression that your male friends maybe feel kind of shame that when they see you, that they kind of feel they a certain obligation for themselves to serve as you did and as you are still doing while they're not doing it? Could that be, might be a part of the thing that makes it more difficult for you to talk?
I don't think I can speak about that. What I imagine is maybe it's not necessarily shame, because shame implies that you have to believe that this is your responsibility as well. And there are, I think, a lot of people who sincerely believe that serving in the military is not for them. You know, I've spoken to some people, and it's a weird thing to say, you know, but I've spoken to some people who are not necessarily my close friends, but, you know, associates, who ended up telling me, you know, I don't think this is my issue. I don't think this concerns me, to be honest. Which is a crazy thing to say, right? But I think for those kinds of people, it's more of my presence is more of a inconvenience, because it's more of a reminder that there's like work ahead. It's more of a obligation socially than mentally. I don't ethically or morally for some people. So I don't know. I'd rather not think about it too much, because it's awkward, and I don't think I'm in any kind of position to judge anyone or feel a certain way. You know, I do what I do. Other people do what they do. It's fine. Because I have a lot more ethical and moral pretensions towards people from outside of Ukraine. You know, if you're a Ukrainian man, regardless of whether you're in service, like, I love you and I appreciate you and you're my family. But man, people from Germany, for example, boy, or people from the US, I mean, the US is technically our enemy now, right? They're actively taking steps to stop helping us, which they're still helping us a little bit. I do appreciate that. But they're actively going towards making sure that Ukraine loses the war or accepts Russia's conditions. But yeah, any Ukrainian man who's not even in service, you know, I have endlessly more respect for them than for any American. Sorry.
Talking about like the current situation, you already mentioned like the situation with the United States. And there has been a lot of talk about a ceasefire lately, but no clear agreement has been yet signed, and it's unclear whether there will be ever any agreement at all. What is your personal opinion on a ceasefire?
It sounds very temporary, you know? It doesn't sound like the end of the war, or it sounds temporary. So, of course, the fire will start again, because it's Russia. You can't ever trust them. You can't ever have an agreement with them. We've tried many times, ever since, from way back in the 90s, you know. Nothing, no agreement with Russia will hold up, ever. That's, you know, just something that all Ukrainians realize. But regardless of that, I think, well, that ceasefire, whatever it may be, it implies, or rather it, Russians will only agree to it on the basis of us giving them territories that they have occupied and signing them over. And Ukrainians, we're just not going to do that. You know, if we have to keep fighting, we'll keep fighting, you know, because the ceasefire proposals that I've heard basically imply that we give Russia what they want. You know, this fascist government that had started a war in this country that has been conducting essentially a genocide for 3 years and, you know, a small-scale war for another 7 years. Let's all just, yeah, they're right. Let's give them what they want. Maybe, you know, we tried to fight, but, you know, it's okay. They win, you know. Let's just give them a quarter of our country. It's okay. You know, I think that's insane. That's just literally insane. I think telling Russians that it's okay to do this, you can do this, you can get what you want by killing people and shelling people for many years, and no one's going to punish you. It's going to be fine. You know, so next time you have a disagreement with Poland or the US or any other country, you can just bomb them for 3 years and they'll give you what you want. You know, telling Russians that, giving them the green light that this is all cool, is possibly the worst thing you can do in this situation. Like, no, not possibly. Really, it is the worst thing you can do. It guarantees that there's going to be another war with us or with someone else, but Russians will start another war, or they will continue one of their old wars. And yeah, I have no... this ceasefire to me sounds like not only the humiliation of our president, but also I'm going to be humiliated. You know, I'm going to have people texting me and being like, congrats, it's awesome, I'm so happy for you. You know, can you come and play a show for us in Germany or in France or somewhere? And I'll be like, no, I can't. This is not cool. Like, they killed a lot of people and I'm not over it. I'm not going to go somewhere and hang out and have fun because Russians have, out of the goodness of their hearts, they have stopped shelling us finally. You know, there's nothing to celebrate. It's, in fact, it's something to mourn and something to be really upset about and something to plan ahead. It's something that will mean that we have to grow our army, we have to get more people in the military. I'm probably going to still have to do what I do and continue my service, because obviously any ceasefire would be used by Russia to restock their ammunitions and, you know, get ready for another war. That's, I can guarantee that to you. It's 100% true. So that will mean that we in Ukraine will have to amass weapons and personnel and make sure that we're ready for round two, because there's going to be a round two. I have no doubt about it. So yeah, the ceasefire, it's stupid. It's done only for Donald Trump to say that he ended the war, because he was dumb enough to promise this to his followers. I've no idea what an election in the US has to do with me and with bombs, you know, falling on my head and all everyone that I know. But essentially, for some reason, he made it into his campaign promises, and now he has to do it. So he's going to do it by agreeing to whatever Russians want. Well, too bad for us. know, obviously when he, you know, either finishes his term or when we don't agree to the terms, the war is going to start again. But at that point, you know, if he's not going to be the president of the U.S. anymore, he's going to be able to say, well, I did what I promised. I ended the war. Just because they started again, it's not my fault, right? So, sorry. Yeah.
I assume for you, as a soldier of the armed forces of Ukraine, it's very difficult, like, to hear Donald Trump talking when he even suggests that Ukraine will be handing over territories that are currently occupied by the Russian Federation due to the fact that you know personally people who died fighting in these places. How is that for you?
It makes me so angry, I can't even tell you. I don't have the words to describe it. But also, I think it's important to stress that I'm not... The size of Ukraine and how many regions it has is not necessarily important to me. I don't really care, you know, if Ukraine is big or small, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that we don't give the Russians, the fascists, what they want, because there's a fascist country next to us. And if we tell them, yeah, if you kill a lot of people, you'll get what you want. That's fine. No one's going to take you to The Hague and do a criminal court, you know, and put you in prison. No one's going to do that. You can just, as long as you have more weapons than anyone else, you'll be fine. As long as you have the atomic bomb, you'll be fine. It's that to me is the problem is encouraging Russia, because we're never going to be, the people that they've killed, no one's going to bring them back, right? They're dead. It's over. It's not, I'm not going to see them again. But what I want to make sure is that at least my children have a safer future, but they're not being killed by Russians again. And telling Russians that, yeah, if you fight with enough cruelty and if you do murder people as much as you can, you're going to win, giving the bad guys the victory, you know, that to me is insane. And it's going to lead to more deaths everywhere. It's inevitable, you know. As long as we have a fascist country that's technically the largest country in the world in terms of land mass, not in terms of population, but still. The one, like, is it 1/7 of the land mass of the earth? Maybe 1/8, I forget. But that being like a huge fascist shithole, sorry. How do we live with that? How do we continue to exist in peace and as, you know, a mutually respectful society? You also have to understand that any fascist government can only stay in power by being in a state of war, because the Nazi Germany, it needed a war to be constantly happening, because the only way for a fascist government to stay in power is to tell the population that we are the only people who can protect you. We are the only people who know how to win this war, and we're in a war, and you have a lot of enemies. That's why life is so horrible. That's why we don't have a lot of food. That's why we're poor. That's why the production lines are making shells instead of making, you know, toys or something. That's why the economy is in this wartime mode. It's because we have enemies and we have to fight them. And that is also one way to make sure that you never have to have an actual, real, honest election, or you don't need democracy, you know, so you can be fascist as long as you have an enemy and you're at war. So the Russian government, they're never going to admit, you know, that, okay, there's no reason for us to be at war with anyone. We don't have enemies. No one's actually killing Russians for the crime of being Russian. And so there's always going to be a war. Just, it's a question of with whom. You know, if you look at the history of independent Russia, it's always had a war. It was either preparing for a war or, you know, actually waging war on someone. So yeah, doing a ceasefire on those conditions, it's just giving Russia time to get more weapons and, you know, enlist more people.
This leads me to my last question for the podcast. What are your plans for the future, like when the war will be over? Do you have any plans for this future after the war?
It depends on how the war ends, because if it's a ceasefire, that's not really the end of the war, right? But someone from outside of Ukraine can ask me, you know, the war ended. What's your plans? You know, what are you doing? And I'm like, no, it's a ceasefire. It's going to start again in 10 years, in 5 years, in next year or something. So I don't really make plans anymore. It depends on what is left of us when the war ends, if it ever ends. It's possible that I'll never even see the end of the war, so I don't think about it. You know, I'm in the military, I'll do what I have to do every day, and I'll do some fun stuff after work or on Sundays and Saturdays, maybe.
Timur, thank you so much for taking so much of your precious time talking to me, and I'm sure you have every right to be very angry with many people. I'm very sure about that. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for asking uncomfortable questions, I suppose, or letting me say uncomfortable things. Thank you. I hope you have a good day.